From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yes, thank you, Simon. It's a scorchio in Salford. Temperatures approaching 90 degrees and it's going to be very warm over the next couple of days as well. It is Tuesday's programme, the 23rd of June. 4 years ago today, we voted to leave the European Union. Imagine that.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Right, David Vance, the political commentator and journalist, joins the programme this hour to talk about, I suppose we will reflect on the fact it's 4 years since we voted to leave the European Union. We will talk about the easing of the lockdown, and we'll talk about the cancellation of Conservative commentators by social media companies, and we might even talk about Burnley football fans and White Lives Matter. We might get into that. In the second hour, an old friend of mine, John Perkins, returns to the Richie Allen Radio Show. A lovely, lovely guy, a great gentleman. You will, of course, know him from Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He's written 10 books now. His new book is Touching the Jaguar, Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World. John Perkins, hour two, from a sweaty studio in Salford. Scorchio. Can't but channel the amazing Caroline Ahern. Scorchio. Yes, it sure is. So then, Boris Johnson, your Prime Minister, my Prime Minister, addressed Parliament, depending on where you are, and he addressed a nation on tenterhooks today to announce further easing of the dreaded lockdown. Yes. What did he say? Well, he talked about restaurants, pubs, hairdressers, and the distancing between us, the 1 metre point, whatever, the 2 metres being reduced to one. And let's just hear Sky News presenter Colin Brazier, because he sums up what the changes are, and then we'll hear from the Prime Minister, Colin Brazier of Sky News.
Hi there, good afternoon. Welcome to Sky News today. Pubs, restaurants, cinemas are just some of the businesses that can reopen from the 4th of July after Boris Johnson announced measures to relax the lockdown, at least in England. Social distancing rules will also be eased from 2 metres to what Boris Johnson called 1 metre plus. The Prime Minister admitted current measures make it impossible for some sectors of the economy to reopen, but he warned that all decisions were reversible should there be a spike in coronavirus cases. Well, these are some of the changes the Prime Minister has announced for England.
You ready now with the changes?
Where it's not possible to stay 2 metres apart, people are now advised to be at least 1 metre apart, as well as taking other precautions, things like hand washing or being outdoors. Pubs and restaurants can reopen from the 4th of July in a COVID-secure way.
In a COVID-secure way, pubs and restaurants.
But they should limit indoor gatherings. They must also take contact details for customers.
Keep that one in mind. They will have to take your contact details if you want to get a pint of whatever your tipple is.
Households will be allowed to mix with one another, one other household indoors, and will be permitted to stay overnight.
Now, you will now be allowed to mix with people from another household. And if somebody wants to stay the night, well, you're allowed to do that now. You have permission.
You should still maintain social distancing, but there is no limit on the size of those households. Two households of any size will also be able to meet outdoors, an increase on the previous limit of half a dozen people.
Except on a Wednesday when you get rudely awakened by the dustman.
Hotels.
Hotels now.
B&Bs, campsites can also reopen with plans in place to deep clean rooms in between stays.
I'd like to think they deep cleaned the rooms in between stays anyway. But then I remember Ramsay's Hotel Nightmares, and when they would shine the ultraviolet lights on the sheets, mother of Jesus, it put me off hotels for years.
Stays. Museums.
Museums.
Cinemas can all resume operations with smaller capacities as well as staggered start times.
Staggered start times. What they mean by cinemas is every second row will have to be empty. So row one, people. Row two, nobody. Row three, people. Row four, nobody. You get the picture, yeah?
Hairdressers and nail...
Hairdressers!
...bars can reopen too on July the 4th, but with strict rules, including the likes of wearing visors, spas and beauty salons, however...
Visors!
...however, remain closed. Playgrounds, libraries, community centres will also be allowed to reopen.
Allowed. I love the term allowed.
And places of worship can reopen for services, and weddings can resume with a maximum of 30 guests.
Weddings can resume with a maximum of 30 guests. Oh, Christ. Can you imagine the rows that's going to start, eh? 15 of hers and 15 of yours. Come on, will you? Oh, the whole point of weddings is that you get too many people at the afters and you get people killing one another in the toilets. Those cousins that haven't seen each other for years, that hate one another. It's proper sport. They're ruining everything. What about the Prime Minister? What does he say about it? Here's Bojo.
After the toughest restrictions in peacetime history.
Peacetime.
We are now able to make life easier for people to see more of their friends and families and to help businesses get back on their feet and get people back into work. But the virus has not gone away. We will continue to monitor the data with the Joint Biosecurity Centre and our ever more effective test and trace system. And I must be clear to the House.
Let me be clear.
That as we have seen in other countries, there will be flare-ups.
Flare-ups.
For which local measures will be needed.
Yeah, see Germany today, apparently in Germany, a slaughterhouse. Hundreds of people tested positive. And Novak Djokovic, who didn't want to take a vaccine, ironically was told he had COVID anyway.
And we will not hesitate to apply the brakes and reintroduce restrictions, even at national level, if required.
You hear that tyrannical little bastard there? You hear him? That rotten, vile little bastard? We won't hesitate to apply the brakes and reintroduce the measures at national level again if required. You hear that? He should be hanging from his ankles in the Tower of London.
So I urge everyone to stay alert, control the virus and save lives. Let's keep washing our hands.
Jesus.
Staying 2 metres apart wherever feasible, mitigating the risks at 1 metre where not, avoiding public transport where possible, wearing a mask when you have to use public transport, getting tested immediately if you have symptoms, self-isolating if instructed to do so by NHS Test and Trace. Today, we can say that our long national hibernation is beginning to come to an end and life is returning to our streets and to our shops. The bustle is starting to come back and a new but cautious optimism is palpable. But I must say to the House, it would be all too easy for that frost to return. And that is why we will continue to trust in the common sense and the community spirit of the British people to follow this guidance, to carry us through and to see us to victory over this virus. And I commend, Mr. Speaker, this statement to the House.
Oh God, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space were it not that I have bad dreams. This is a reality. Crazy. They did say, though, that there won't be any more daily briefings after today. We've had them every day for months. This is all part of the charade, of course. This was the theatre. You know, during wartime, the Prime Minister, during the Iraq War, beautifully named Iraq War, the Iraq Genocide, it should have been called, during the Iraq Genocide, of course, Blair would appear in front of the media every day and Baby Bush would do the same thing in DC. This is all theatre to create the illusion that we were at war with some unseen deadly enemy. They had practice. You know, they've been warning us for years that we're at war with an unseen deadly enemy. The terrorist cells. Creeping and lurking around every street corner. Horse shit, of course, in reality. So they've had practice. This is crazy stuff, right? It really is. Let's stay with the pubs then, and let's stay with Sky presenter Colin Brazier. For the second day in a row, he had Emma McClarkin on. She's the chief executive of the British Beer and Pub Association. And data protection and privacy is a problem for many boozers in the new normal. And it's brought up by Colin Brazier.
Yeah, it'll be the Great British Pub, but it won't be the pub they remember necessarily. I mean, partitions, the distancing that you outline, but also this idea that if track and tracing is to work effectively, people must give up some personal details when they enter a pub. They've got to give their name, perhaps an address, a contact number, that sort of thing, which for some people will sit uncomfortably with the idea of a pub being an unbuttoned place where you go to relax.
Yeah, there is new elements been introduced to the guidance that we've worked on with the government, and one of those is the collection of data. Now, we do have some significant concerns around this from a GDPR perspective, but also about how we store that, how long we store it for. So we're going to be working with the government again to find out exactly how they see this register of contacts working. We do want our customers to feel confident. So if this is necessary in order to fight coronavirus, then we're prepared to work with the government to find a practical way to make this work, but we don't want to put anybody off coming back to the pub. But we hope that the message today from the Prime Minister about reopening the pubs, about that safe socialising environment, has gone through, and people will begin to feel more confident about stepping out of their homes and coming back to the pub.
Not me, though. I'm not going to the pub. I would imagine you're not going to the pub either, to be met at the front door, to be guided to a table, protected by screens, instructed to sit with my back to people, and then to give my name, address and telephone number to the publican, to the bar person, before I get a drink. No thanks. You can stick that up your arse. I'll go and get a carry out. Here's an old-fashioned term for you. A carry out. The Conservative MP Philip Dunn welcomes the new easing measures and reminds us all that it won't ever be totally safe until what? Until what, do you think? You can guess, Philip Dunn.
There's always risk in life. People, you know, we could get run over by a lunatic. You could be having a, you know, picnic in a park and somebody comes up and does something terrible that's happened to those, that awful tragedy in Reading over the weekend. So we all accept there is risk. I think when it comes to meeting people, certainly within the family context, one has got some understanding of the sort of isolation people have been living through for the last few weeks. But it's the chance encounter with a stranger in the street that I think people will continue to be nervous about. That's why the introduction of face masks, I think, provides some degree of reassurance to people. And the real reassurance will come when we've got a vaccine.
When we have the vaccine.
Surprise. Between the eyes, the unpredictable. That's the surprise you see.
Surprise, surprise.
But of course, it won't be reassuring when the vaccine arrives, and the lockdown measures won't disappear entirely when the vaccine arrives either. It's nonsense. Because by the time the vaccine arrives, you'll have to have a digital health passport, and your movements will be just as restricted as they are now, unless you can declare or prove that you've had the vaccine. Philip Dunn there, Tory MP. But the pub and restaurateur managers and manageresses themselves are really happy, amazingly, and they are telling BBC reporters that they will enforce the new rules. They will stay on top of us if we enter these establishments. Here's a woman called Nisha from Mowgli Street Food in Liverpool. You'll hear her and then you'll hear the BBC reporter winding the segment up. Nisha is a manageress. Do you want to hear her? I'd like to hear her as well. Here she is.
If we get a second spike, it will be the end of the majority of restaurants. It is that serious.
Right, she's saying basically we've got to really, really crack down on customers to make sure they're following the rules. Because another spike will finish restaurants and pubs once and for all gone if they have to close again, right? Right.
If we get a second spike, it will be the end of the majority of restaurants. It is that serious, and the end of those jobs that I protect so fiercely. It's so important that we do actually shepherd the way that people are behaving, because
shepherd the way that people are behaving, she says,
because they do forget themselves. And if we do it in a gentle, courteous way, what we do is we secure our very lifeline.
In a world where crowds are the new enemy.
What? This is the BBC reporter now. This is the programming we talk about.
In a world where crowds are the new enemy. Some.
In a world where crowds are the new enemy. Crowds replacing Islamist jihadists, you know?
What kind of fuckery is this?
Crowds are the new enemy. What are we going to do about all of this, eh? Me and you. You and me. One person allowed in a toilet at one time. That's including the gents, by the way, in these establishments. Jesus, huh? You won't be so quick to break the seal from now on, will you? When do you break the seal, by the way, dear listener? I bet you if you're English, half a lager. Half a lager and you're breaking the seal. We know the Sassenachs can't hold their beer, don't we? Alrighty, new normal. New normal. Last night, Manchester City beat Burnley 5-0 at the Etihad in front of nobody except the trainers and the doctors and some press people. It's vaudeville. At the beginning, as is the new custom, the players dropped to a single knee in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. While they were doing that, a plane flew overhead with a banner trailing behind it, reading, "White Lives Matter, Burnley." Everybody was disgusted. The commentators were disgusted. The players, the Twitterati, juggiers Gary Lineker, even though he wasn't working the game. Everybody was disgusted. Burnley said they would ban the guy or guys for life. The police said they'd be looking into it to see if there was any criminality. And the guy who did it took to his Facebook page to brag. His name is Jake Heppel. I love surnames. Where's Heppel from? We got Charlotte in Burnley. Jake Heppel is a Burnley fan, and he organised the banner and the plane. And he went on Facebook this morning saying, or last night, saying, "I'd like to take this time to apologise to absolutely fucking nobody." He continued to say, "It's now apparently racist to say White Lives Matter the day after three white people got murdered in a park in Reading. But all we've seen on the TV is Black Lives Matter after George Floyd got murdered. What a mad world we live in," posted Jake Heppel. He's now gone from social media, but the row rumbles on. A guy called Sanjay Bhandari is the chairman of Kick It Out, an anti-racism charity. Charity, right? Charity. Here's a new phrase for you. Remember you heard it on the BBG? It's a new phrase from me to the racism industrial complex. It's a gold rush. Charity setting up, they get funded by governments, okay? Lots of money, and of course the trustees of the charity, the chair people and all the rest of it, they get nice fat salaries, so long as they find racism around every corner. That's the job. Anyway, Sanjay was on Victoria Derbyshire's BBC show this morning, and she had a good question by way of a viewer email. I like this.
Let me read you this email from Anne, who is watching. "Please can you let viewers know why it is so different for a banner to be flown for White Lives Matter? It seems to be one rule for one and one rule for another."
Well, I suppose what it comes down to is that the words in themselves are inoffensive, aren't they? In the sense that, of course, Black Lives Matter, of course, White Lives Matter, of course, all lives matter. It's about who's saying it, in what context, and why are they saying it. Now, I understand there's going to be a police investigation, so we'll understand exactly who has commissioned this and why. But the reality is that the phrase White Lives Matter has been kind of used, and we're seeing it across the internet and online, is being really used by a lot of far-right organisations to sort of deny what Black Lives Matter is seeking, which is actually equality. No one is seeking preferential treatment. They're seeking equality and not to have their human rights denied. And this is, you know, White Lives Matter is being used as turning this into white v black. It's not. It's everyone v racists.
Yes. And
everyone v racists, really. Derbyshire could do just a tiny bit of research into who's funding Black Lives Matter and how it went from a genuine grassroots movement, which had a lot of interesting things to say, into something totally different, that again wants to transform the world in fairly unpalatable ways. But she just goes on to agree with the guest instead of challenging him.
And using it in that way is a, would you say, is a willful misleading of what Black Lives Matter is?
Way to put words in his mouth, Victoria. Would you say that it's a willful? Why didn't you invite the guy who put the banner in the sky to come on and talk to you? Very simple, you know. I'm sure he would have said no problem. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford, the great city of Salford. And we're about a mile and a half from the city centre of Manchester. It's a 20-minute walk with my legs. From Manchester. Big shout out to my pal Nigel Code, who's listening to this programme in Waterford City, Port Lauraga. How you doing, Nige? Hope all is well. Right, we've got Jeff Beck. Here's Jeff Beck. When we come back from Jeff Beck, I should be joined by David Vance. Looking forward to catching up with David. It's been too long. Right, Jeff Beck on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Hi-ho, silver lining. The time is exactly 26 minutes past the hour. Glorious afternoon here in the northwest of the UK. Really like speaking with my next guest. Fond of what he does at his website. Check it out, altnewsmedia.net. It's more of a news organisation than a website. He's a champion of free speech. He's a geopolitical commentator. You often see him on TV, on Sky and elsewhere. And we first met him some time ago to talk about the BBC. He's been a thorn in the side of the BBC for some years now. Let's welcome him back to the programme. It's none other than David Vance. David, thanks for coming on again today. How are you? We lost him momentarily. These things happen, you know. Let's call him back. He was on there. Unless he decided just then and there not to do it. But he'll be back. David Vance. Let's see, can we reconnect with him? He might be on a mobile device. David, you're there. There you are.
I am, yeah. I am indeed. Yeah,
we lost you momentarily. No problem. Great to see you.
Good to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Before we talk about the things that we agreed to talk about, it is 4 years today since the 52% of the people of this nation, of these islands, went to the ballot box and said no to the European Union Federalist Project. 4 years later, we haven't left. I don't believe that we will leave, but then I'm a natural pessimist. How do you feel about it 4 years later?
What is it they say, Richie? A pessimist is an optimist mugged by reality.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that obviously the establishment is very keen that we remain, and they've fought a long battle over 4 years. My own view is that I think where we're going to go at the end of this year is going to be somewhere short of what we voted for, but nonetheless further than our rotten establishment want us to be. So it's a bit like the proverbial curate's egg, good in parts, bad in other parts.
Fair enough. Let's leave Brexit for another day. Now, I know from following you and reading you that you're a proud a British man. You're proud of your country. You're proud of Northern Ireland. You're proud of the UK. When you see the Prime Minister talking about easing lockdown measures today, but talking about things like you've got to give your contact details to a publican, your name and address and all of that, do you imagine as somebody who thought you lived in a free country, in a proud country, and you'd have been debating with people over the years from other parts of the world where maybe they didn't have a lot of freedom, this is not freedom, is it, what we have today in the UK?
No, it's a scandal. It's absolutely scandalous. And actually, Richie, to be honest, to me, this is a much bigger issue than Brexit, because this is fundamental. This is about our liberty. So when I read, or, you know, say Boris Johnson tell us, oh, good news, you can go from 2 meter to 1 meter staying apart from human beings. And if you're going to go to 1 meter, you might have to wear a mask anyway. It's deplorable, Richie. It's really bad because, you know, I mean, this throughout this whole COVID scenario, what I've come to conclude is that we've got a very weak government. We've got an extremely weak prime minister, especially since he had COVID. But maybe before that as well. And it makes me very alarmed for, you know, for a future. We see other countries around the world, you know, in various stages of COVID hysteria, Ireland being a good example, as you know, Richie. But I have to take great exception throughout this whole COVID scare to the draconian removal of and systemic removal of our freedoms and liberties, which I reject. I totally reject them. So all this today, you know, the celebration, the hallelujah chorus, because Boris has made some, he's thrown a few crumbs the way of the peasants, and they think that's good. Well, I don't think it's good. It's not enough. Social distancing has to end. Lockdown has to end. We've got to get back to business, Richie. Otherwise, you know, as I keep saying to people, you got a choice. You can have you can have your lockdown and your social distancing, or you can have an economy. Choose
between them. Before we talk about the damage to the economy, because we haven't chatted since January, since all of this really kind of kicked off, I imagine after the anti-Brussels vote of 2016, I voted to leave. I know you did.
Yeah.
You might have been... People might have been forgiven then for thinking, ah, there's a bit of spunk left in English people and British people. They, you know, gave two fingers to the tyrannical Brussels project. But then you see how people have acquiesced to these ludicrous measures and done so in a way that has put their livelihoods, their children's livelihood, excuse me, the livelihoods of their children going forward in the future. They've absolutely capitulated. Has that been a source of disappointment to you? Did you not see that coming?
Oh, massive. Absolutely massive. I mean, there's two things, two lessons I've taken from this. One, that yes, so many people are sheep. I mean, we are, never mind a nation of small shopkeepers, we're a nation of sheep. But in the second instance, those people, or many of them, Richie, have been conditioned by particularly the legacy media, you know, the scum media, blasting into their homes. If they've been sitting at home, which they have been for months, watching this, getting this message, as you know, stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives, they've been conditioned. It said it takes between 8 to 10 weeks to recondition a human personality. The government's done that for a lot. So, at the one hand, yes, I feel angry about the fact that these people are so sheep-like, but I also understand in many regards why they have become so sheep-like. And I blame, obviously, government, the propagandists, and the celebs, all the virtue signalers, but the power, Richie, which I really resent, the power of the legacy media and the fact that people sit at home, they stare at the box. They did that back in March, in April. And I think they have become like almost drones controlled by very effective propagandist messages from government. But that's why they do it. That's why they happily hide in car behind the front door rather than, you know, going out there into the big bad world and behaving like adults.
Why don't we learn, David? Why don't we learn? Blair took the country to war against Iraq based on a pack of lies. We were led into a no-fly zone situation in Libya based on a pack of lies, the Foreign Affairs Committee. And the BBC drove this. The BBC drove the Iraq war. Why? When will people stop believing the crap? I mean, I'm asking the right guy. You've spent years yourself highlighting the mendacity of the BBC. When will people stop looking at the BBC and trusting it implicitly in the way they do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And if only I could give you a categorical answer. Yeah. All I can say is, Richie, that the BBC has been vile in this throughout this whole program, appalling. But I would actually, to be honest, extend that accusation right across the piece. Sky News has been appalling. ITV has been useless.
Yeah.
Channel 4, ridiculous. The entire UK establishment
RTE,
media,
my friend. RTE in Dublin. Jesus, don't get me started. Dreadful.
RTE, I know, appalling as well. And actually, this is the very good reason to remove state broadcasters, because at these moments, these statist broadcasters become simple propagandists. That's all they've been. But the BBC, particularly strange one, Richie, if I can contrast with RTE for a moment, because the BBC clearly want to bring down the Conservative government. Because regardless of the ins and outs of how Boris has handled it, and we could argue that till the cows come home, but they've been continually nipping at this and complaining about this. And, you know, what about the ventilators? Oh, and then when that one passed, what about the PPE? And then when that one passed, what about the test kits? Constant carping, constant undermining. So the BBC wants to bring down the government that they never wanted to see elected. Whereas in Ireland, I think, Richie, and you're the expert here, but I think RTE have been more happy to support the kind of totalitarian-esque government you've got in Dublin, you know. So I'm not sure they wanted to change it, but then there's nothing to change it to, I suppose.
Nothing to change it to. It doesn't matter. David Vance is our guest this hour. Great to have him back on the programme. You can follow him on Twitter. It's at DVATW, and it's altnewsmedia.net. Let's briefly talk about, because I know you're a man of business and you know a lot of people in business. I don't think anybody has a clue just how disastrous these months have been in terms of what it's going to mean for us, for workers and taxpayers in the next few years, in terms of austerity, in terms of paying back the unbelievable amount of borrowing that the government is engaged in. And it seems to me, I don't want to harp on about the media, we can move on from the media, but the media is obviously not talking about this. It wants to just ignore that, because maybe if people were to fully understand the economic impact of it, maybe they would rise up against it and say enough is enough. But it is going to be massive, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. And you're dead right. Most people do not seem to understand that there's an absolute economic holocaust happened. It's happened, Richie. The only reason people don't see it is that what I call all the zombie companies, they're still there. They're still more or less going because they're using the furlough scheme in the UK to sustain their presence until we get to the end of that time. So come autumn, when the leaves of autumn fall, so will vast amounts of UK business. Now, we're seeing some things fall now, but that's just the early waves coming up the beach of this tsunami. The huge waves that are going to sweep away so much are going to come in the early autumn. I speak to business people, Richie, around the UK, all kinds of companies. I think there's a general acknowledgement that it's going to be really bad. And that's why Boris's nonsense talk about, you know, we've got to get British business back on its feet. It's all nonsense. It's political claptrap. Business people have been starved of profits for 3 months. Most companies, Richie, most certainly small to medium-sized companies, cannot endure being starved of your profits. You know, you use up your funds. Yes, you're keeping people in a job, but you're not making any money. If you don't make money, you go out of business. And that's before you get into the fact that the hospitality sector, you know, the pubs and the clubs and all, that's been crucified. The leisure centre sector has been crucified and continues to be. So, yeah, the people do not understand this. And the deeper problem is, Richie, I believe that after this time, there's a section of people seem to think that they have an option of not going back to actually doing their jobs, but being paid.
Yeah.
That's non-sustainable. Those people don't realise it, but they're actually unemployed at the moment. It's just that they're still getting this, you know, weekly or monthly 80% from their current employer. They will be made redundant. So it's very.
What you're saying is, sorry, David. This is an important point to kind of flesh out. What you're saying is, many of them don't actually realise the danger that they are in. They don't realise it, that they won't have a job to go to. See, that's terrible, but that's the media again. You know, they should know, shouldn't they? They should know that it's unsustainable and that their bosses are, it's just going to collapse. And when the furlough scheme ends, many of them won't have bloody jobs to go back to.
Yeah, so at the worst time of the year, so when the summer nights draw to an end and the autumn's beginning to creep in, those people are going to suddenly be woken up by the awful reality that that which was happening in March and April killed their employment. But they can't see it, and the media doesn't particularly want them to see it. I mean, the media still kind of hungers for, can't we just, you know, extend the furlough scheme? Can't we, and this is non-sustainable on economic basis. I mean, there's no way it can be extended. It shouldn't have been there in the first place, in my view.
No, but, and what's horrifying, sorry to interrupt you, David, what's horrifying is, for me, and I know I use that word maybe too much, but it is horrifying. You've got Sky News economics editor who writes for The Times, Ed Conway. That louser is proposing bail-ins, wealth taxes on people in the future. And he's also proposing that it's done in such a way that people don't have a chance to protect their own bloody money. Do it in the middle of the night. Ah, oh, there's your man Vance now. Yeah, let's take £1,000 off of him. It might be all you have because we just can't afford it. It's absolutely mental, this. Why am I talking to you about it? It should be 9 o'clock news, this. It's the biggest story in the world and nobody's talking about it.
I know, but that's often the way, Richie. The scum media do not, and they haven't pursued the real stories over this entire period concerning COVID. Instead, they've gone down little rabbit holes of their own. The real story is that the decisions that have been taken by government, very ill-advised, are going to cause economic holocaust. That's just the way it is. And as I say, a big chunk of that's already happened. There's more to come. And it will all become evidenced in the early autumn, at which point the same media, which is kind of played along this game, they will all turn in Johnson. You can see it coming. They're going to say, well, Prime Minister, why, you know, look at the 2 million people on the dole. This is unimaginable. And yet, for months, they've argued, they've agitated to try and keep us all at home, behind our doors, with the economy in free fall. And that's, Richie, why the UK probably is going to be one of the most severely economically impacted in the world.
David Vance is our guest. This is hugely important information. This, I told you where you can follow David. I will give another mention. I know many of his listeners do follow him when he does these appearances. Altnewsmedia.net, and it's at DVATW on Twitter. Let's turn to Black Lives Matter. Look, growing up in the media, I mean, I've worked at most levels of the media. I've met people from all over the world, from different backgrounds, different ethnicities. I'm not what you'd call, I don't know, a snowflake or a liberal. I like to see myself as an old socialist. I'm a trade unionist. You and I would disagree on so much, but who cares? I enjoy talking to you anyway. I don't have any cornerstone on the bloody truth. You know, they're just my opinions.
But, likewise.
And likewise. None of us do, right? But I love shooting the breeze with people who see the world differently to me. I'm prepared to accept that there is a kind of a bias against people from ethnic minorities. Now, I don't believe in white privilege. I'm going to say that straight up. I don't believe in that. But I do believe that people from ethnic minority backgrounds, they are exposed to maybe a bit of bias, maybe that we don't experience ourselves. They do come across it maybe a little bit more when dealing with the authorities, when dealing with banks, when dealing with employers. And I have a bit of sympathy with that. But what's been happening of late kind of leaves me cold, this Black Lives Matter movement, the taking down of statues, people being encouraged to a very strange thing. It's not good enough to be anti-racist. I find this kind of very disturbing. You must be doing something to show the rest of the herd that you're actually on the side of minorities. How have you read this? This came up, of course, in the last few weeks with the death of George Floyd. Your thoughts on this, David?
Yeah, well, I mean, on the Black Lives Matters, I mean, I actually think it's fundamentally racist because, you see, unless you can state, as I believe you do and I do and I'm sure many listeners do, unless you can firmly state that all lives matter, if you then start to carve up a little ethnic chunk, and it could be Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, Brown Lives Matter, I'm afraid I think you're a racist. Black Lives Matter, in my opinion, is a Marxist organization that's got very little to do with, nothing to do with race relations and everything to do with, you know, kerching money in its bank account. It's yes, it's got the stated aims, Richie, which amazed me of, you know, it wants to bring down capitalism. It wants to defund the police. It wants to empty the prison. It's there on the website, folks. Go and check it out. Yeah. So when you see crony corporatists, like we see the Premier League, for example, Richie, we'll maybe talk about that. But these crony corporatist organizations literally on their knees to an anti-capitalist Marxist organization, it makes me laugh at one level. And in another level, it horrifies me because they're going to have to be resisted. That we need to completely reject everything that Black Lives Matter stand for. Because what Black Lives Matter stands for, to me, it's racist, it's dangerous, it's poisoning race relations. I mean, like yourself, Richie, I go back a few years. I remember life in the 70s and stuff. You know, I know what it was like back then. And yes, I know that the past is a different place, but I thought this country had come along and, you know, by and large, people rubbed along mostly okay. Yes, no country's perfect. But, you know, if you want to find proper racism, here's a tip. Go to Africa. You might find some of it there. So let's not be lectured to and patronized about our country, imperfections and otherwise. And so Black Lives Matter, to me, is a cynical use of the tragic death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. It's spread like wildfire around the world. We see our history being dismantled. We see the most ludicrous demands being made. But more worrying for me, Richie, we see our craven political establishment unwilling to actually stand up for their own heritage and culture and values, and this is the thing that disturbs me. You know,
before we talk about Burnley, let me just interject there, because I think back to Black Lives Matter a few years ago. I think there was a genuine grassroots movement there, but I think it's been certainly co-opted. I know you're absolutely right. I've seen the massive corporations, Google, Disney, and others, that are funneling large amounts of money into it. It's a political organisation now. It will produce candidates, I have no doubt in my mind. But I do think, and I'm not any snowflake liberal, I am no virtue signaller. Gee, I get dogs abuse here, I am not. I do not believe the UK is institutionally racist. I do not believe that. I don't believe that the majority of people are racist. But I do think that black people particularly, I think there are some genuine grievances, and I think it's a pity maybe what we've seen with this organisation maybe kind of obfuscates what might be still genuine grievances that black people might still have.
Well, can I come in and say, I agree that it's because people talk about, you know, the BAME community, but this issue is pretty much around the black community. Because, for example, here in the UK, people of Indian origin, people of Chinese origin, they perform very well economically, educationally, and so on and so forth. And for me, Richie, this whole thing is a sideshow, because there are issues in the black community that we need to deal with and try and fix, one of which is that there are so very few black families where there's a dad in the household to help, you know, make sure that if there's boys, they've got a role model and stuff.
That's not unique to black families now. You're talking to a bloke whose father left when I was 13, and thank God he did, good riddance to him. Most of the people I know, believe it or not, white people growing up, their parents split up. So, you know, you're going to get dogs abuse for saying that, my friend. You know that.
Yeah. I might get dogs abuse, but I can bite back. And let me tell you that you're absolutely, again, Richie, I very rarely disagree with you, believe it or not, because of course that what you're saying is true in the white community as well, for definite.
Yeah.
Nowadays. But it's been true in the black community for a much longer period of time. And if you want to talk about the United States, where so much of this originated from, it's endemic in the United States. And the level, you know, so all I'm saying is that if there's problems to be dealt with, I think reasonable people like us would say, yes, there's an issue in that community. What can we do to help support kids, keep them in education, keep families together if possible? You know, do things like that. But you know something? Trying to bring down British history and heritage ain't the way to achieve that.
No, it isn't.
That's alienating, and that's going to cause what I think we're beginning to see, which is a kickback against it.
Why didn't they just change the plaque when people campaigned on Colston? I mean, it's not rewriting history, but you could have just put on the plaque, look, here's the guy, he was influential, he had friends at the time, he was powerful, but he did, and he took part in something that was you know, terrible, and it has a legacy today. And you could have left the statue standing. I totally agree with that. I think economic reasons are the reasons why people's families split up. I don't think it's unique to, and I know you didn't say that. It's certainly not unique to black families. It was economic reasons that really saw the end of my friends' parents' marriages and them splitting up when we were young and all the rest of it. But I want to talk, I want to stay on this theme, because this young, I don't know how young he is, this young chap, Jake Heppel, who's a Burnley fan, who decided to fly a banner over the Etihad Stadium last night. I think it said White Lives Matter Burnley. And he's left social media today. He's taken quite a lot of abuse. The usual suspects came out to condemn him. And this is what really worries me. We could argue all day long about whether that was the right time for Jake to do that. I think whatever time he wanted to do it is his own business. I would never tell anybody to self-censor, because I'm not a hypocrite. So if he wanted to do it yesterday, good luck to him. Others might say, hang on a second, Jake, do it at another time. However, the police, David, what's going on? The Burnley police saying, you know, we're looking into this. This is tyranny. He's entitled to his opinion, right?
Yeah, good old Burnley police, Richie, unable to deal with the grooming gangs that operate in Burnley with impunity for years, unable to deal with that, but suddenly seized with an opportunity, with the zeal to solve something that isn't a crime, because it wasn't a crime. There's no law that's been broken. So on this one here, I mean, with regard to the banner being flown over the Etihad Stadium with the White Lives Matter. I mean, my view on it is very simple. If it's okay for players inside the stadium to wear Black Lives Matter insignia on their shirts, what's wrong with having White Lives Matter flying in a banner over the stadium? And of course, it's a rhetorical question.
I know
exactly what the reason is. That we're at a point in a country which is, let's be honest about it, 85% still white. I mean, it's still a majority white country. It's seemingly now deemed offensive to say that white lives matter. And particularly within, 48 hours of three white men being stabbed to death by someone from Libya in Reading, I thought, surely white lives have never mattered more. So why do people not care? And also, as I said, my top line in this is, I think this race baiting is terrible thing.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Honestly, Richie, I don't want to see white lives matter. I don't want to see black lives matter. If you want to say all lives matter, you'll get my support, and then let's deal with any particular community with underneath that. But the response of Burnley Football Club, for example, has been, they're angry, they're embarrassed. Why? Aren't most of their fans white? Do they hate their own fan base? What's the problem with Burnley Football Club? What's the problem with, for example, Talk Sports Radio, who on their social media to my chagrin, they have blocked me because I asked them, did they understand what the aims of Black Lives Matters are? Answer, no, they don't. All they understand is how to virtue signal.
You got blocked by a radio station. I mean, that's thin-skinned in the extreme, isn't it? A radio station blocked you.
Talk Sports Radio.
That's garbage, isn't it?
Talk Sports just can't take. Actually, because I try never to be abusive to people, I always ask questions like, do you understand what Black Lives Matter stands for? And if you do, then fair enough, that's okay. But then surely you must respect the right of people to say white lives matter. But if you could down that one, Richie, you're gonna, it's race baiting.
It's ridiculous. Can I say something to you? Can I say something to you? I ultimately believe that no lives matter. Now, you're not stupid. You're a very intelligent guy. So you know which radio show you're on. You know the sort of things I believe. I believe that we're subject to some sort of crazy depopulation agenda. I really believe that. I believe this climate change nonsense, all of this is to transform humanity, to bring us to a place where human life, human existence will be unrecognisable. Guess what? Nobody is going to be exclusively a victim to that. We all are. Every bloody one of us. And yet we kill one another, fighting over who's the biggest victim, who's getting it worst from the state. And all the while, our freedoms are being ripped away from us. They want to mandatory vaccinate us against stupid viruses that don't really exist next year or the year after. They want passports for everybody. It's tyranny, David. And while we're killing each other over the colour of our skin, the people behind this agenda are going, lovely. Keep killing yourselves. Keep arguing with one another, right?
Yeah. Hey, listen, I agree with all of that. All of this, as is always the way, Richie, and you understand it. I'm sure many of your listeners will also understand this. This is distraction games.
Yeah.
They're very violent distraction games, but it's all about conditioning us to a whole new way of existence, a whole new way of existence, which is fundamentally antithesis to us as being human beings. You know, I see a vision of us being a masked society, you know, whacking vaccines into our body each year to protect ourselves against something which isn't that much worse than a flu.
Yeah.
And in pursuance of that, I think and I'm not sure if we'd agree on this, but I think that the people behind all this would love to see the fall of Donald Trump. And what we're seeing in the States facilitates that. And if Trump was to fall, I think you'll find that, you know, the globalist agenda that you're not too keen on might suddenly expand 100 times more under sleepy Joe Biden. So, yes, we have to understand the real narratives that are in place. They're narratives, Richie, which is so valuable that shows like yours, you know, do this. You actually talk about, and we try in our way in Alt News to do this as well, talk about the matters that are crucial, but the crucial things are never discussed on the scum media.
No.
Therefore, we have to talk about them, and you do a great job doing that.
No, mate, thanks for saying that. Before we run out of time, I want to ask you about the deletion of Katie Hopkins. I'm not sure exactly why Twitter decided. I don't know which tweet it was, but she did.
I did.
Well, she tweeted, I remember she tweeted Marcus Rashford. And I grinned when I read that tweet, and I'll tell you why. Because it reminded me of my new pal, Kevin Myers, whom you know wrote for the Sunday Times for years and years and years. And years ago, Kevin wrote the most inflammatory article about women in Mexico, as you'd call it, you loyalist, the Republic of Ireland, in Mexico. He wrote about girls taking the easy way out, clever girls, just having babies because the state would pay for them. And there was murder, right? I remember talking about this on radio in the 90s. It was a brilliant article. It was a bit satirical. Now, I've never met Katie Hopkins. I know you know the woman. I have opinions, but my opinion of her is of no relevance to anybody. They can't be banning people and kicking them off just because they say things like that. Or was that the tweet, or was it something else?
First of all, I'm very pleased to be a friend of Katie's, and so I'm very aware of everything that's gone on. And actually, ironically, she was banned from Twitter for a tweet that referenced a Blackadder joke. So
no way.
That's a reality. She had been, quite honestly, what happened was one of the many vile haters that she gets, Richie, and you wouldn't believe the scale of hate that's shown towards Katie on Twitter. Somebody made a vile suggestion with an intent of violence behind it to her, and she said something like, well, you better be, quote, hung like a baboon.
Right.
Hung like a baboon. Captain Blackadder actually says it, I think, in Blackadder Series 3, as a joke. So she was making a joke. Now, here's the bit where it becomes insidious. Somebody then took that and either played the race card with the reference of baboon or the hanging aspect from the phrase. And on the basis of that, 1.1 million followers, gone.
Right.
No appeal, bye-bye. That's what happened, Katie, on Saturday night. Now, I think I know that there was an organization behind this, the Campaign for Countering Digital Hate, I think they're called. Certainly one of their senior people was on talk radio, ironically, on Sunday to claim the victory, the scalp.
Is that right? So, I've coined a phrase, my friend. I call it the racism industrial complex.
Yes.
The racism, and there's so many charities now that exist and they get government grants, loads of money, so long as they keep finding racism. I tell you what, David, if they paid me enough money, I'll say, yeah, I see racism. I see it over there. I see it over there. I mean, this is ridiculous, isn't it?
It's self-fulfilling, but I think the sad thing is, and the tragic thing is, that a voice, like, you don't have to agree with Katie, or indeed anybody. I have never sought anybody to be banned from any platform. Doesn't matter, they could be extreme left. I don't care. It's fine. Have your views. But it's this censorship of disparate opinions which is making Twitter such a sewer, and that's why people like myself have migrated across to Parler as well. So I've got multiple platforms. If you're on Parler, look me up at David Vance, my proper full name. You'll see me there. And Katie's over there as well. And so many other great people are going over there. We're not going to be held hostage to Twitter, Richie. And I know that one day they'll come for me. I'm sure about
that.
No
doubt, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They'll come for you as well, Richie. They'll come for every one of us. And that's why I feel that all of us people, regardless of where we sit on a political spectrum, need to stand together under the auspices of trying to defend free speech, that the right to say what you think without fear or hindrance. And if Twitter won't allow that, we'll find other places to do that. We won't be stopped. It was people that made Twitter great, Richie, not the other way around.
David, great to have you back on the programme. Altnewsmedia.net, and David is on Twitter. Huge following there for now. I hope you don't get banned. It's at DVATW. Delta Victor Alpha Tango Whiskey, I think. DV. Yeah. There you go, the old alphabet. DVATW. Thanks for coming on. Don't leave it so long to come back. Love chatting with you, David, as always.
Great to chat, Richie. Absolute pleasure. Take care.
Love it, mate. Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye for now. David Vance live on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Tuesday. It is exactly 6 o'clock in Salford. Yes, I can hear the town crier there. If I just be quiet for a minute, you hear him? No? All right. We'll have some music. John Perkins. What a great guy John Perkins is. John Perkins is on the show shortly, and we're going to be talking about his brand new book, which they kindly gave me last week, and I have been reading it, and I'm really enjoying it. It's part adventure story, that's totally true, right? We'll get into it in a couple of minutes. Here's music from Billy Swan. Billy Swan on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Scorchio. Billy Swan on the Richie Allen Radio. It goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. That's the ordinary 3.5 minute version. I don't know about the 12-inch version of it. Oh, yeah. It is absolutely boiling in studio here in Salford. Hope your day's going well. It is exactly, what time's it now? 5 minutes past the hour. John Perkins standing by and will be with me in a couple of minutes' time. You don't want to miss him talking about his brand new book. I've got to say, and I've said it before, if you read one book before you die, it's got to be Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's an incredibly important read. It really is. And listen, before we get John on, let's go to FSN for headlines. Because you never know what might have been going on in the time we were chatting with David Vance. Headlines back in 30 seconds.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says from the beginning of next month, England's hospitality, tourism and leisure industries can start to reopen. President Trump now says he wasn't joking when he claimed on Saturday that he'd ordered a slowdown in COVID-19 testing in the United States. And John Bolton's memoir has gone on sale in America. It is already a bestseller.
Yeah, John Bolton's memoir, eh? John Bolton, what a disgusting human being John Bolton is. Right, where are we then? Something is telling... Yeah, okay. Let's get rid of that. Let's have a look at some of your comments. No, I knew I had something else to do. I knew. One of those days, when it gets warm, I get a bit mad. Back in a minute.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyursky.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Right, welcome back. Welcome back, welcome back. Look, free speech is important. Now, that's an obvious statement. But I interview some people sometimes and we chat away. And by nature of the fact they are on the programme, it suits certain people to assume or to insinuate that I must be in total agreement with those people. I'm not. I enjoy interviewing people with whom, my worldview would be entirely different. But I like them anyway. I like listening to them because they're articulate and they make a cogent argument. I've been interviewing David Vance for a couple of years, and I know that to many people on the so-called left, they don't like David because of his background and because of his points of view. But it doesn't matter to me what his background and what his points of view are. Don't be making assumptions, you know. And as for the young man who flew the banner over the Etihad Stadium yesterday, I'm not in agreement or I'm not in disagreement with the young man. I don't know what is on the young man's mind. I wouldn't mind interviewing him, but I wouldn't be going on air calling him a racist without knowing anything about him, apart from the fact that he took a photograph of himself with your man Lennon, Tommy Robinson, a couple of years ago. That's not, you know, reason enough for anybody to make a judgment and say, oh, the guy's a racist. There are a lot of very, very complicated issues at stake here. Listen to my interview with Raja Mia about Oldham and grooming gangs in Oldham, and why he believes those grooming gangs have been allowed to operate, you know, in Oldham, and why the Asian vote is courted in places like Oldham by politicians there, why that is, and why often working class white people, not everywhere, but in these places, are ignored and become an afterthought. These are real things. But nobody wants to talk about these things because people fear being labelled as racist or bigoted. But I don't fear that. I couldn't care less. It's 10 minutes past the hour. Let's get John Perkins back on the Richie Allen radio show. Huge interest in this, unsurprisingly. I will be looking at your tweets as we go along. Do tweet the programme. As usual, it's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I met my guest this hour. I met him about 11 years ago, I was doing a radio show in Spain, and he was very kind to come on with me every 2 or 3 months to chat with me about the issues, about things that were not being discussed in mainstream media. That was very humble of him, because even then he was a best-selling author, selling millions of books worldwide, New York Times best-selling author. I've mentioned before, Confessions of an Economic Hitman is a gift to humanity. And it's the one book I think everybody should read before they die. He's got a brand new book out right now. And his assistant was very kind. His publishing company was kind to send it to me last week so I could read it. I'm nearly finished reading it. It's outstanding. And I recommend you read it too. It's Touching the Jaguar, Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World. Let's welcome the shaman, the whistleblower, the teacher, the peace activist, the world traveller, the best-selling author, John Perkins. You are welcome back to the Richie Allen Show. John, how are you?
I'm great, Richie. Thank you so much. How does one live up to that kind of an introduction?
Well, you have lived up to it. And when I was reading the book over the weekend, knowing that it's true that these experiences you had in the jungle, in the Peace Corps, were real, it's so well written, John. It's so well written. It transports you to the jungle and the experiences you had there and becoming ill and living at subsistence level. It's extraordinary. It reads like an adventure book, that section of the book. It's a brilliant read. Thanks so much for writing it.
Well, thank you for saying all that, Richie. And I just have to say, it's wonderful to be on your show again. I love our conversations. I love your show. You do such great work. Thank you so much.
You're very kind. It's been too long since you were on. Hey, look at what has happened since you, before we talk about the book, and it is brilliant, John. Look, my word is important to me. My listeners know that I endorse very little. It's a wonderful book, and I recommend my listeners get onto it immediately. Before we talk about it, the book would have went to bed before everything exploded this year. How do you feel about that? Because the book is so relevant now.
Yeah, you know, it is. It's of course, I had no idea about the coronavirus or all the racial issues that are going on around us today all over the world. But what I did know when I wrote the book was that we were having a phenomenal, horribly phenomenal number of hurricanes, earthquakes, fires, all these once in 100 year events that were happening every year or so. That we were being told the Earth is speaking to us, and you can look at that from a shamanic standpoint, or you can look at it from a purely scientific standpoint, that we're getting a very strong message that we need to change. And so what's happening now, the pandemic and the racial issues, that's just another very, very strong message. But this one's global. Those others were local, and this one's global. Everybody on the planet's being shaken awake by what's going on. So the book is extremely timely. And yet, of course, when I wrote it, I didn't know about these issues, but I knew there were other big issues that were giving us these same messages, similar messages.
And you knew these things were coming anyway, because we've been speaking for 11 years, at least every year or so, you and I get together. And these were things that you saw coming down the line. Talk to us about, I mean, the book is just, it's gripping. You're turning page after page. Talk about your Peace Corps work in the late 60s, taking you to Latin America, your experiences there, that crazy journey that you took where you ended up getting so sick that you went to see a shaman. Tell us about that, John, in your own words, because it's absolutely amazing.
Well, thanks, Richie. Yeah, you know, that experience really defines some of the main themes of this book, and the main themes I think are that our reality is totally molded by our perceptions. And today we see a world that's in terrible crisis because we've created it with a perception around economic success that's given us really what we call a death economy. And shamans have told us for a long time that we need to change that to something that we could call a life economy, to create a new perception that makes that happen. And one of the other things is that every one of us, every one of your listeners has a role to play in this. But when I was there in the Amazon, that's when all of these things really came together for me. This is 1968, I went to the Amazon. And shortly after I was there, I got very, very sick. I was dying. I was a Peace Corps volunteer, and I was deep, deep in the jungle, as you said. I was very sick. I couldn't stand up without help. And to get to the nearest medical facility, I would have had to hike and take rickety old buses for 3 days up into the Andes, about 10,000 feet up. There was no way I could do that. So I was really resigned to dying. And one night, a Shwa shaman healed me. Shwa were the indigenous people with whom I was living. And he did that by taking me on this shamanic journey, what we might call a vision quest. While I was on that vision quest, I was really in an altered state. I saw this amorphous form in front of me. I had my eyes closed. And the shaman yells at me, "Touch the jaguar." Well, Richie, I'm in the middle of the jungle. Yeah. You know, like, it's night, it's dark. I look all around like, where's the jaguar? I was terrified. And he says, no, close your eyes. You know, touch the jaguar you see. So I closed my eyes, and this amorphous form shifted into a jaguar's face. And I heard a voice like my mother saying, "The food and drink will kill you." And I realized in that moment, Richie, that you know, I was eating some very strange foods by my standards. Things like a delicacy there is squirming white grubs live.
Oh, my God. When I read it, John, I was imagining, I was wondering, would I have had the courage to eat that stuff? The answer was no. Go ahead.
You would if you were starving.
If you were starving.
No Cliff Bars, you know. There was no other food. And people don't drink the water from the rivers because they know it's dangerous. The rivers are, you know, have organic matter. Trees fall into them and rot and so forth. So the women make a kind of beer called chicha by chewing and spitting manioc root. It sets up a fermentation process. Then you can add water. And you got to drink a lot of this stuff because you got to rehydrate in the tropics. So I had to drink a lot of spit beer and squirming like grubs. And I saw in this vision quest that every time I did that, I heard a voice saying, "It'll kill you." At the same time, I saw how very healthy the Shwa were. They're robust. They're vital. They're hunters and gatherers. You know, I mean, for goodness sakes. And they live to be very old if they're not killed in a hunting accident or something like that. And so I saw that night that it was not the food and drink that were killing me. It was my perception. And that was creating a reality for me that was illness. I saw that all that night. And then, you know, I got much better. And the shaman then required for as payment that I become his apprentice. They had no money. There was no currency. It was all a barter society. So, and this is, now it's 1969. I've graduated from business school, never even heard of a shaman until I get there. There was no future in shamanism in 1969. I had no desire to do this, but God had saved my life. So I studied with him. And later, as I tell stories in the book, after I got out of the Peace Corps, I studied with shamans in Indonesia and Iran and Egypt and all over the Americas. And I kept discovering that the primary principle of shamanism is that our perceptions mold our reality. And then I began to understand that that's also the basis for modern psychotherapy and for quantum physics. And for corporations, you know, the perception, advertising, marketing is all about perception molding our reality. And I came to understand that, you know, there's no England, there's no Australia, there's no United States, there's no New Zealand, there's no corporations, there's no religion, there's no culture, there's no human institutions except ones that we've perceived. And when enough people accept a perception or mold it into reality, when enough people accept a perception or codify it into law, it then becomes molded into reality.
That must have been mind-blowing for you, coming from where you came from, you know, the east of the United States, the business background, to be there in that situation in the 1960s. It's almost like the Stone Age, pre-telephones, at least cell phones anyway, computers. You're there, you can't get away from it, you have to embrace it. And you're learning about changing your perception and changing the world around you. Your mind must have been blown by that, John.
It was totally. And I have to say at the beginning, and when I was sick, I hated it. Yeah. You know, the only reason I was in the Peace Corps was because of the Vietnam War. I was determined not to go. I didn't believe in the war. I didn't want to go off and try to kill people I had nothing against or be killed by them. So what kept me there in the early months was the knowledge that if I wasn't there, I'd be in Vietnam and would have been drafted.
Something that Muhammad Ali said was very profound for you. Am I right in remembering that from the book? Muhammad Ali said something about the Viet Cong. Maybe you said it to me before, and that was important for you, you know, that you don't have any quarrel, I think, with the Viet Cong.
Yeah, it's in the book. He said, you know, they ain't never called me racist. They never tried to kill me. I got nothing against them. I'm not going. Basically, that's what he said. I'm paraphrasing it. But yeah, and you know, I had once I decided to join the Peace Corps, I asked for the Amazon, and everybody thought I was crazy. But the fact of the matter is, I grew up in rural New Hampshire. I come from over 300 years of people who lived during the time of the early settlement of New England in the United States, the East Coast, and they lived with the Abnaki, the Algonquin-speaking people, and the Iroquois. And I had I'd grown up with a deep fascination for woods lore. I spent my youth as a kid. I spent a lot of time in the woods, and so I knew there was one place on the planet where people still lived in similar ways, and that was deep in the Amazon. So I asked for it. I wanted to live that, but when I got there, the reality was very different from the romantic picture I'd had of this. And actually, these were not northern forests. This was, you know, Amazon rainforest. and I hated it at the beginning. But after I started studying with the shaman, and I became accepted by the people, and I began to understand the people, and my perceptions changed about everything, not just the food, but about all their ways of living that at first seemed so primitive. And, you know, they didn't use soap. I've been brought up to be very hygienic. These people haven't seen soap, but they're very clean people. They do it in other ways. They're very clean. And I began, you know, it was the perception changed and my reality changed, and I fell in love with it. And, you know, I still go back there all the time. I'm scheduled to go in August this year. I can't now because of the coronavirus.
Because of the virus. Let me ask you this. Sorry to interrupt you. And I've been dying to ask you this. I want to hear more about you going back there. And I know you've been there for years and years. In fact, one of the interviews we did some years ago, you were, I know you were deep in the Amazon when we did it, and we managed to do it over a phone, and it was marvellous. And I remember the noises in the background, the beautiful bird sounds. It was incredible. I was reading, the book is fantastic. We're talking to John Perkins. You know John's books, you know who John is. Touching the Jaguar, Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World. I recommend you read it. Here's the thing, right? Over the years, I've often fantasized about indigenous tribes in remote parts of the world. And I've had this fantasy that these people would be deeply just people, that there would be very little crime, that they would be honest, that they would elevate their elders rather than throw our elders away into homes and forget about them, I think, like many of us do. And that rather than primitive, I mean, you just said it yourself, rather than be primitive, they're actually in many ways more advanced than us. So I've had this romantic vision of what the hierarchy of these indigenous tribes would be like. Am I right? Is my romantic vision, I mean, it comes across in the book a little bit. How do you feel about, you know, my perception of what it must be like to be living in a tribe like that?
Well, yeah, and I've spent a lot of time in those places. And I say in the, actually in the beginning of the book,
yeah,
that I do not idealize individual indigenous people. There are brutal ones and there are peace-loving ones. There are very sane ones and there are insane ones. They're human beings. They've got all, you know, as individuals, they've got all the issues that all the rest of us have in many ways. But what I do idealize and what I do respect is that as cultures, traditionally, and that's changed as progress moves in, but traditionally as cultures, they've had a long-term view. So they look at the world as being a place that they need to pass on better than they inherited it to their kids or grandchildren. They need to take care of nature. They see their deep interrelationship with nature. That's ingrained in their culture. Our culture, on the other hand, as I write about the death economy, yeah, is driven by the goal of maximizing short-term profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. Or for individuals, maximizing short-term materialistic desires, regardless of what it does to the environment and society. And theirs is not. And that is something I deeply respect. Again, it's not about the individuals, but it's about the overall driving force in their cultures. And I've also come to understand, Richie, that we all come from cultures like that. Out of the 250,000 or so years that we've been human on this planet or seen ourselves as humans, we've lived most of that time in what we call life economies, like what they do, where you really look at the long term. You want an economic system that's rejuvenating, that's it is itself a renewable resource, the system itself. And throughout most of our history, that's how we've lived. It's only been with the last kind of the blink of the eye of human history that human beings have been driven by this very selfish, very greedy idea that we've got to maximize short-term materialistic gain.
When, I mean, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, most people I've met now have read it. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 2 years. It sold and sold continuously since then. We know about the follow-up books, of course, as well. And Hoodwinked, of course. You move back to the United States, and our listeners are eagle-eared, and they know you, and they love you, and they'll be saying, John, you spent the time, the shaman, and I love reading this in the book, it's an amazing, I'm going to say it again, it's a great read. You're with the shaman, and all he wants in return for helping you is that you become a sort of an apprentice for him, and you learn from him. And then you go back to the United States, and then begins one of the most important parts of your life, obviously not the most important part, because you've gone on to do great things and you continue to do them. But your hitman phase, where basically you begin to come back to that part of the world and arrange loans for countries by predatory banks to get those countries into trouble. So some of our, I suppose, more eagle-eared listeners will say, John, how did you go from your experiences in 1968, 1969 to getting back into that world, that corporate world and the banking world, and then going back and doing, you know, that part of your life, the hitman phase? How did that happen?
Yeah, it's a very important question. And the answer ties right in with this theme of perception creating reality. I was in the Peace Corps in Ecuador for 3 years. But I'd come out of business school, when I got out of the Peace Corps, I did what I'd been trained to do. I became an economist with a major consulting firm. I became chief economist quite quickly. My job really was to convince, to identify countries with resources our corporations want, like oil. Ecuador was one of them. And then to convince that country to take huge loans from the World Bank or its sister organizations. And the money would have to be used to hire our companies, U.S. corporations, that would make huge profits by building infrastructure projects in these countries, power plants and industrial parks and highways, things that benefited a few wealthy families, the ones that own the industries, that own the commercial establishments, and so forth. And that also increases GDP. So when you all the statistics, all the economic models show that when you make this kind of investment, you increase the economy, which is defined as gross domestic product. I believe that. So I believe that what I was doing at the beginning was a very good thing. I was helping these countries become more prosperous. And it took a while for me to understand that this is just a perception, that GDP is a false perception of prosperity. It measures the very rich. It's totally skewed in favor of the rich. So I could say in my own country right now, the United States, three individuals have as much wealth as half the population of the United States.
Yeah.
If those three individuals made 10% return on their investment last year and half the population lost 3%, we'd still show a gain of around 5%. A little less than 5%, which still show an increase in GDP. And it took me a long time to understand that because my education and everything I was doing, you know, all the World Bank, everybody I was working for, you know, supported the system, still do. They still say that this is the way to economic growth. It's only the way to growth for the very wealthy. It does not measure overall success, overall prosperity, and it's created this what we call a death economy that's actually consuming itself into extinction, that's destroying the environment, that's destroying the social fabric, that really is causing that what's behind the riots today, what's behind the coronavirus, what's behind climate change, what's behind species extinction, that's all being caused by this measurement and this definition of success as being maximizing short-term materialistic gain. But it did take me a while to see that, Richie. And once I saw it, once I was able to see through the old perception that created this reality, it's that theme again, then I had another perception I had to overcome. I had a really big jaguar I had to touch. And so, you know, the shaman, when he taught me, after that, he taught me touching the jaguar really means identifying your barriers and fears, identifying them, really confronting them, touching your barriers and fears, and changing your perceptions around your barriers and fears so that you can receive the energy, the inspiration to take the actions to move forward to change your life and the lives of people around you.
Do you think
we can get it? More later. But once, you know, so once I saw that this was a false perception, this GDP, I didn't want to believe it because I'm suddenly, you know, living the American dream. I came from a pretty poor family, a teacher in a very wealthy boys prep school. But we grew up without very little money, surrounded by wealthy boys in New Hampshire. Now I'm living this dream of making a big salary, traveling first class around the world, meeting with presidents. I didn't want to believe what I knew to be the truth. And eventually I had to touch that jaguar and see that I really wasn't happy doing this. And maybe it was what the perception was, the American dream, but that was only a perception too. The reality was that I was miserable and I had to get out and change it.
Maybe your shaman teacher from Ecuador, and maybe the shamans that you've met around the world, they might say that you needed to go through that. You needed to witness that and to see that. That it was an important part of your development, maybe.
Yeah, I think they would say it was an initiation, and I feel it's the same. My daughter, who's in her 30s now, was interviewed by a magazine, and they asked her, you know, so what do you think about all the awful things your father did as an economic hitman? And she said, well, yeah, you know, I know at the time he didn't realize they were awful, but I know he may regret it today. But she said, I'm grateful that he did those things because he totally understood the system and he now has the credibility. He was a chief economist. He speaks the language. He can go out and talk to corporations and bigger international economic conferences, which I do. I was just at one with 12,000 people in Russia, and I've been in China, and I've been all over the world speaking at these conferences. And she said, so he understands the system from the inside, and he has the credibility to speak about it. And so I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know. And for me, it was sort of a personal initiation. And in the larger sense, it also put me in a position where I am able to tell the stories that you so beautifully honored in with the words, as you said earlier. I do write this as a narrative nonfiction through telling real stories, true stories, because I think those are fun for people. Those are more fun to read than some sort of a, you know, economic treatise that uses fancy economic terms.
No doubt. And it's been those who've read the book, people like Deepak Chopra and others, have loved the book just as I've loved it. And one or two people have said it begs to be, you know, a screenwriter should take it, because it would be an absolutely beautiful film. Just to remind our listeners, we're speaking with John Perkins. I don't need to tell you who John is. Amazing guy. JohnPerkins.org. I'll put his website on our Twitter. John's on Twitter as well. The new book is an outstanding read, right? It's called Touching the Jaguar, Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World. But I will say something, and I've said this to you before and I mean it. It took some courage to write Confessions, because you're not stupid. You knew that that was potentially a death sentence. You knew that, didn't you, when you wrote it? I mean, you're exposing one of the key secrets to how our civilization works and whom it benefits. You knew that.
Yeah, well, it would be nice to think that I was very heroic, but the fact of the matter is a little different than that, in that after I quit being a chief economist, economic hitman, I did that for 10 years. In the early 80s, after I quit, I started writing an expose to explain what I'd done. And I contacted other people who had jobs like mine, economic hitmen, and the jackals. We haven't mentioned the jackals, but these presidents of countries knew that if they didn't accept the deals I was offering them, there were people behind me that we called jackals, who were usually CIA assets, who would either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And the United States, unfortunately, has a long history of this. You know, we've admitted that we were deeply involved in the overthrow and the death of Salvador Allende of Chile, and Arbenz of Guatemala, and Mossadegh of Iran, and Lumumba of the Congo, and Diem of Vietnam, and on and on and on and on and on. And so I started, after I left the business, I started writing this book, and I contacted other economic hitmen and jackals to get their stories. And very quickly, I received anonymous phone calls threatening my life and that of my, at the time, infant daughter. And I took these calls very, very seriously. It was terrifying, because I knew what these guys could do. And then I got invited out to dinner by the president of Stone & Webster, a big engineering consulting firm that was had been a rival of my company. And he said, you know, you have a great resume, chief economist of this company, and we'd like to use your resume in our proposals. You don't have to do any work for us. Just let us use your resume. And I'm prepared to write you a check tomorrow morning for $500,000, $500,000. This is in the 80s, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
$500,000, nothing to sneer at today, but back then it was even better.
Yeah.
And he said, just don't write the book. So suddenly, Richie, I'm being hit the same way I hit presidents of countries. I'm being offered the big carrot, $500,000 for doing nothing, a consultant's retainer, which is not illegal. It was definitely a bribe, but it was not illegal. And at the same time, I'm being told, hey, the assassins are there in the background, the jackals. And so, you know, unheroically, perhaps, I took the money. I didn't use it in my own defense to buy fancy cars or big houses. Yeah, I went back to Ecuador. I went back to the indigenous people. And I just said, I want to help you save your forest. And out of that, I formed a couple of nonprofits. I co-founded the Dream Change and co-founded the Pachamama Alliance. And I wrote 5 books on shamanism and indigenous people.
Yeah.
The World As You Dream It, Psychonavigation, Shapeshifting. But I didn't write the book that I knew I needed to write. So that wasn't terribly heroic.
It was, though. That's why you're loved. That's why people love you, because it's warts and all with you. It always has been. Warts and all. You tell the truth. It was kind of heroic. I know it was. You know, people threatening family, these jackals hiding around corners, people offering you money. It's serious. And you went back there. and this is detailed beautifully in the book, you go back. And when you go back, and I want to talk in a few minutes, I'm only mindful of the time. I don't want to be interrupting you, you of all people, but I'm looking at the time. You've got plenty of other interviews to do. And I want to talk in a minute about the five questions, which is an amazing thing. We'll talk about those in a minute. For every human being on planet Earth, these are questions you should be asking yourselves. We'll talk about those questions with John. But you go back. And when you go back and you use the money to put it to good effect back in the Amazon, you see with your own eyes the results of the things you were doing as an economic hitman. That must have been, again, all of these experiences are transformative for you. They must have been.
Yes, absolutely. I saw how now these rainforests are being destroyed by Texaco, now Chevron, and other oil and mining companies. And basically they're being, as the shamans told me, what's destroying these forests is, yes, it's the oil companies, it's the mining companies, but really it's the dream of the people behind them. And they, by dream, they mean perception. It's the perception of the modern world that requires oil and the minerals that are mined. So they said to me, go back and help your people create a new dream. And that's why I created these nonprofits and wrote these books. And this current book, which is, you know, Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World, it's about changing perception so that we alter reality. And I, you know, the story of how I ended up then writing Confessions, the other side of that, so I didn't write it because I get this bribe and threats. And then on 9/11, I was in the Amazon with a group of people. But when I came home, I flew to ground zero. And as I stood there, looking down into that pit, I knew I had to write the book. But this time I decided not to write an expose. I wouldn't contact anyone else. I would write a completely personal story, my confession. And so I wouldn't have to contact anyone else. I'd write it in complete secrecy. And I'd write the whole book, not a proposal, the whole book. And I figured that once I had written that book and got it in the hands of a good New York agent, and he's sending it out to publishers, it's my best insurance policy. So that's how eventually the book came about. Was I when I saw that hole at ground zero, and there's no direct connection. I'm not trying to make a direct connection, but it just, I got hit like, Jesus, you know, you've got to expose the system that you're part of. And that system is behind most of the crises that our world is facing today.
John Perkins is our guest. We've got John for another 10 minutes. This is fascinating. The time is flying. I am going to keep mentioning the name of the book. I know you will check it out. It's a terrific book. It's life-changing stuff. Touching the Jaguar, Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World. And John details when he goes back to the Amazon, meeting a tribe that hadn't been contacted by, you know, anybody before, and experiences. I don't want to give too much away because you have to read the book for yourself. But you do talk, before you talk about the five questions, can you, as briefly as you can, I hate to be telling you to be brief because I could listen to you all day, and I mean that. Can you just answer a couple of quick questions coming through on Twitter and on Facebook? Ayahuasca. How important, what is it? What can it do for you and for people?
Well, it's a plant. It's a sacred medicine, basically, that's made in the Amazon. You've got to combine a couple of plants together. And, you know, I was trained as an ayahuasca shaman. That journey I was on was with ayahuasca. It's a powerful mind opener, if you will. But I want to say that it's not by any means the only one. You talk about these five questions, which come out of that, which everybody can do for 10 minutes a day or once a week if you want. You can go into this process that I describe in the book that will take you on the same kind of journey. So this plant or other plants that a few shamans in the world use as an opener, but most of shamanism does not use these plants. So the Mayan people of Guatemala, where I take groups, they use fire ceremonies, which take you to an altered state, or every bit as powerful. Meditation, there's all kinds of different ways of opening ourselves to really transforming our jaguars, to touching our fears and our barriers, to identifying them and to changing the perceptions around them, and then taking the actions necessary. And I have to say, I'm a little concerned about the way ayahuasca is being used these days. It's almost become like a social addiction for some people.
Yeah.
A guy asked me the other day, he said, hey, I took ayahuasca 20 times this past year. How many times have you taken it? John Perkins. And I said, the last time I took it was 10 years ago, and I'm still processing that.
That's incredible.
So, and that's what I was taught, you know, but that's how the indigenous people do it. The shamans may take it every time they give it out. They take a little bit and then they give more to the client, but they're very careful because they realize that all of these things that open us to what we really want to do with our lives and what's keeping us from doing them and how we change the perception so we can move through that. All of these things also require discipline and work afterwards. You don't just keep going through the process over and over to get up more and more highs, if you will. You need to take what you've learned and do something with it and really apply it. And that gets into those five questions you've referred to.
Yeah, and just before the five questions, one other question which might be a bit stupid, but I was brought up to believe there's no such thing as a stupid question, so I will ask it anyway. The shaman you've met, and because you learned that you can change, by changing your perception, you can make serious positive change, not only in your life, but in the wider world. And you're living proof of that. Does that mean, and this is, again, it's stupid because we could be here all day talking about this, is that evidence that the world is not what we think it is in terms of its physicality, that it is something different? What does shaman think about that? The world being, well, I don't want to get into this kind of holographic and all that. I don't want to get into any of that, but that we can change the makeup of it.
There's so many answers to that question. Yeah. It's a profound question. And let me give just one answer. So right now we've created this world, which I think we all know is teetering on the precipice of disaster.
Yeah.
There's climate change. There's no question. There's species extinctions. There's income inequality. There's racial inequality. And there's a pandemic right now. And there's so many things going on. And they've all been created by this reality that comes through a perception. And the reality is this death economy that everybody's out there, or most everybody, there are exceptions, but the most everybody's out there struggling to maximize their short-term materialistic benefits. And that's the driving force behind corporations. That's based on this perception of short-term gain. If we change that perception and we say the perception is no longer short-term gain, it's to maximize long-term benefits for people and nature. And that becomes a driving force behind corporations. We create a life economy. And I go into detail in the book about what a life economy is. But in essence, it's an economic system that pays people, that pays investors returns, and pays people to have jobs that clean up pollution, that regenerate destroyed environments, that recycle, that create new technologies for energy, communications, transportation, everything. And we've been moving into that, Richie, with things like benefit corporations and Green New Deals and conscious capitalism. We've been moving into that. And I think this virus and all that's going on in the world today is pushing us further. So yes, that perception of what it means to be successful has created a reality that can be easily changed by changing the perception. And that's one example. There's many levels where our world is created by our perceptions.
Brilliant. Let's finish for today on the five questions that people should be dealing with for themselves on a daily basis. Just before we do that, touching the jaguar, transforming fear into action to change your life and the world. We're talking about it. It's John Perkins' new book. John, the five questions.
So in a way, Richie, the stories I tell in the book, which I think are fun to read, exciting, lead us into this daily practice, or we don't do it every day, and it takes less than 10 minutes when you do it. But the practice is defined in the book, but it is based on five questions that we can all ask ourselves, no matter what our jobs are, and I'll give a couple of examples. So the first question is, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? What will bring me the greatest satisfaction, the greatest bliss? I would answer that by saying, I want to write. A friend of mine, the opposite end of the spectrum, says, I want to work with my hands in wood. I'm a carpenter. And the second question then is, how do we apply this vision of our own future in a way that will help others? Because we're all happier if we help someone else, one other person or the whole world. So as a writer, I would say I'm going to write stories that inspire people to transform a death economy into a life economy. My carpenter friend would say, I'm going to use sustainable materials. And the third question then is, what's blocking you? What's the jaguar? What's the fear? What's stopping you from doing this? As a writer, I might say, I just don't have enough time. to write every day. And my carpenter friend might say, well, my clients aren't interested in paying more money to use sustainable products. They're just not willing to do that. And so when you, then you, the fourth question is, how do I touch the Jaguar? How does that change my perceptions? For a writer, it would be, well, listen, I can get up half an hour early every morning and write, or I can watch an hour less of television every night and write, and I can do it every night or, you know, three nights a week, but I'm going to discipline myself to cutting out some time from something to allow me to write. And when the carpenter touches that Jaguar, the Jaguar says, hey, tell your clients that's not a cost. It's an investment in the future. They may pay a little more for sustainable materials, but then they can show their son or their daughter, look, the carpenter built this cabin or built us this house using sustainable materials. This is an investment in your future, son and daughter, and your children's future. And then the fifth question is, what actions do I take today, every day? And you apply this. That's why you go through the exercise every day. So for a writer, it might be I write another page today, or I write another chapter. But for the carpenter, it's, well, I'm going to go out there when I'm building this cabinet or this house, I'm going to keep telling my clients, hey, look what you're doing. You're investing in the future of your children because you're paying a little bit more for some of these materials, but it's not a cost. It's an investment.
Yeah.
And so we each go through these questions. And the answer to the last three, how do I change my perception? What actions do I take? Those will change periodically. You know, we'll move through. We'll touch certain Jaguars, and then other Jaguars will arise once the book's written. I got to go to a publisher. Confessions of an Economic Hitman was rejected by 39 publishers. That was a lot of Jaguars I had to touch along the route. Not to just give up, you know, or to go jump off a bridge or something. Those questions can change, especially the ones at the end, every day or every couple of days. But that's good, because we keep, every time we touch a new Jaguar, we rise to a new level of consciousness. We rise to a new level of personal satisfaction.
It's been a real pleasure to have you back on. It's been too long. I know you spend so much time traveling around the world. I did interrupt you earlier on when you were talking about your revisits, your regular visits to the Amazon. I know you were hoping to go back again in August. I hope it won't be too long before you go back. Folks, you've been listening to John Perkins, and I'm going to recommend again that you read Touching the Jaguar, Transforming Fear into Action to Change Your Life and the World. It's available at all good bookshops and online bookshops. And for more on John, it's quite simple. Go to johnperkins.org. Thanks for your time today, my friend. Godspeed to you. Look after yourself. I'm glad that in these crazy times, people like you are in the world doing what you do. Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Richie. Thank you so much. Thank you for your incredible show. I love your show, and I'm so honored to be on it. Thank you very, very much. Keep up your great work.
You're too kind. Thanks, John. Loved having you back. John Perkins, folks. You know, John, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, 10 books, millions of sales, TED Talks, world traveler, shaman, gentleman in every sense of the word, and great teacher. Check out his new book. Go to johnperkins.org. The time is 11 minutes to the top of the hour. It's more like 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Great to have John back on the program. Hey, listen, when John was talking about climate change there, I know one or two of you might have wanted me to jump in and say, oh, I don't believe in anthropogenic climate change. John Perkins is well aware that I don't believe that man-made CO2 is killing the planet. There's no need for me to keep jumping in and saying that. Where I'm in total agreement with John is on everything else, and the fact that I believe that we are destroying the environment. I don't mean we are. I know you're not doing it and I'm not doing it, but there is a deliberate agenda to destroy the environment, to pollute the rivers, the lakes and the seas, to render the earth uninhabitable. It's done in so many different ways. Geoengineering, I would argue. I don't think John would agree with that, but it doesn't matter. Fracking, although not so much these days, thanks be to God. So now, he's an amazing guy. The book is a terrific read. I recommend you get it. I won't say that again. Right, let me read a few tweets then. It's bloody warm, eh? It's bloody warm. Just a reminder, by the way, before we go any further, two things. One, I won't be with you tomorrow. I've got personal business to attend to tomorrow afternoon. I won't be back in time for the radio show. I did mention this yesterday. Tough shit, Paddy. That's the way it is. I won't be with you tomorrow. Simon Dolan is going to be with me on Thursday to give us an update on what's going on with his case against the UK government and the lockdown. But I want to give a shout out to Natalie Stacey. Now, I should have done this not only last week, but I should have done it the week before. Not because of any obligation, but because I wanted to do it. Natalie Stacey is a big, big friend of the Richie Allen radio show. I've met Natalie in Manchester at the free speech event organised by the Trigger Warning Boys, the Meet Space event. Lovely, lovely, lovely lady. Very bright, very articulate, very intelligent. And for some weeks now, Natalie has been presenting a music show on triggerwarning.tv, which follows this programme. So as I depart, and I'll be departing from you in about 5 minutes' time, Natalie will be beginning her music show, which is dealing with metal music and heavy metal music and hard rock music. And I've listened to a bit of it, and it's very, very good. I'm not the biggest metal fan in the world ever, but I recommend it. Hayden Hewitt loves it, and he is one of the biggest metal fans in the world. And it's improving week on week as Natalie gets more comfortable doing it. And it's on Trigger Warning, 7 o'clock. It is repeated, I believe, on Sundays. But Tuesday evenings at 7, just after me, Natalie Stacey. So basically, break a leg, Natalie. Well done for throwing your hat into the radio ring. And check her out at 7 o'clock on triggerwarning.tv as I ease out the door for a very cold beer. It's boiling. And I get this thing all the time. Why don't you get some aircon, BBG? Listen. The Richie Allen Show operates on a shoestring budget. I don't have corporate sponsors. I don't have advertisers. Right? Bestowing upon me enormous amounts of money. So I've got to cut my cloth to fit my measure. Now, the studio is beautiful. It's got all bells and whistles. It's got every last detail in amazing technology. But I don't have a couple of £1,000 to get a decent enough aircon unit. Well, it wouldn't be. It'd be more like 1,500 quid. And I don't care. I'll sweat it out until I can afford one. But that's the way it is in the independent media, you see. You've got to cut your cloth to fit your measure. And that's what we do. That's what I do. All right? It's absolutely sweltering in the studio. I believe when I'm out and about on my personal business tomorrow, it's going to be sweltering as well. And I believe it'll be sweltering on Thursday. But then on Friday, it's going to break up. We're going to have thunderstorms. And those thunderstorms will bring cooler weather. That's according to the BBC. The only thing the BBC gives you these days with any accuracy is the weather forecast, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Hi to you, Kate. How you doing, Kate? This is Kate Vignoles. Do you pronounce that Vignoles, Kate? Nice to be chatting with you on Twitter. Hi to Diane, my friend Diane, who was on the programme, of course, talking about her experiences as a transsexual woman. How you doing, Diane? Was in touch with me yesterday. Hi to Faisal. Hi to Bass Ninja. Hi to Trevor. Trevor says, I wonder if John had taken ayahuasca when he saw the jaguar. It's not apparent in the book. And I've read the book, nearly completed the book. No, I don't think so. He was gravely ill with dysentery. He was all over the bloody place, eating the foods that he had been exposed to when he arrived as a Peace Corps volunteer in 1968. It's incredibly well described over several chapters, and it's very gripping. And the spit beer that he talked about. I mean, if you look this up on YouTube, you'll see this being made, spit beer. It's gruesome. It's grim. It's where the fermenting process is done by women chewing this thing and spitting it into a bucket. It's dreadful. And I believe I'm such a coward, I believe I would die. I would actually die. Such a coward am I when it comes to things like that. In other ways, I'm not a coward. In other ways, I've faced physical challenges in the past and I've met them head on with some degree of bravery. But when it comes to that sort of thing, I would just expire. Yes, I will just die peacefully in my delirium. But anyway, that's just me. Right, so that's it. So I won't be with you tomorrow. I'll talk to you on Thursday. I might drop in on social media once or twice. You might catch me on social media over the next day or two. In the meantime, check out Natalie Stacey on triggerwarning.tv. She'll be live in about 5 minutes' time. And later on this evening, Graham Booth will be live on the Trigger Warning platform. Go to youtube.com/triggerwarningTV. Graham Booth, who's often heard, of course, with Hayden Hewitt from Live League fame. Graham is on later on. It's usually around about 10 o'clock, maybe a bit later. All the details, youtube.com/triggerwarningTV. In the meantime, look after yourselves and one another. Thank you so much to John Perkins for his time this evening. And thanks again to David Vance, who was on the programme with me in the first hour. Going out with this, I love closing the programme with this because it's beautiful and it means a lot to us, I think. It's Louis Armstrong and this amazing song. Enjoy the sun. It's going to be shining until about 10 o'clock this evening. Get out in it. See you later. Bye now.